Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans, episode 148. We got a good one for you here, but we also have some really good sponsors that I just want to tell you about real quick before we begin these shenanigans, if you will. Oh, boy, I tell you. Our first sponsor, Adirondack Brewery, located in Lake George, New York, right there on Canada Street. One of my favorite breweries to visit and just a really cool place to go eat delicious food right in the heart of Lake George. And they got all different types of beers all year round. So they just are a great stop, a must stop if you're up in the upstate New York region. This week they have their cider release. They're coming out of Hibernation Party. Join them on Wednesday, May 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Pub and Brewery as they officially unveil their Lake George Cider Project. Their cider is made from 100% New York State McIntosh, Empire, Spy Gold, and Gala apples and fermented with dry Chardonnay yeast to create a juicy flavor with a dry, crisp finish. Entrance to the party is completely free, and so is the food, beer, cider, and even massages. Yes, massages and cider. They're coming out of Hibernation Parties not only to kick off the summer, but it's their way of saying thank you to all their customers. So check out Adirondack Brewing, just a great place. Demented Brewing, which is located right over here in Middlesex, New Jersey, right off of 287. One of my favorite breweries to visit in New Jersey. Just a really amazing tasting room, sour programs, barrel programs, different things every single Sunday. They got a lot of things going on. They just released Awesomely Demented, which is their Belgian quad. And then this Sunday, they're going to be releasing Mostly Mosaic, their Mosaic wheat beer. And today, this will be yesterday when this comes out, they released Astarte and Gallows Hill in cans. Okay. So Demented Brewing, just a great brewery in New Jersey, cranking out some of the best beers we've got. All right. And the last brewery that sponsors us, how cool is that to have three brewery sponsors, is Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, in the old bank building on Main Street. They just released Alt F4, their German alt beer, this week, and their Maibock called H-Town Hells will be out on Mayfest, May 20th. They're closing down the town, doing food, music, great beer with Zigmeister, another great brewery right around the corner. Also on May 20th is the Beer, Barbecue, and Bacon Showdown in Morristown. Sounds like a bunch of good things going on there. this past week, we've mentioned one of our new sponsors, Susan Robb, who's a speaker agent and a client partner in Canada for the Center for Leadership Studies, where their head office is in North Carolina. And they're excited to have such a business guru. We have a business guru on the episode today, which I'll tell you about in a minute. If you remember the hippo guy, Paul Templer, he's been on our show twice, hippo survivor. Susan is his speaker agent, but is also supporting him to sponsorships as he prepares to interview Gary Goler, who's the first guy in history to climb Mount Everest with one arm. As Gary does the summit again, Paul and his crew are going to do the base camp and do some interviews, and they're looking to raise some money to help that cause out and get that off the ground. So check out Susan Robb, find her on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Finally, Trivia Revolution. Guys, make sure you listen in this episode. There's a trivia question sponsored by Trivia Revolution and Verbal Shenanigans where you can win prizes to maybe some of our sponsors or other New Jersey breweries. Trivia Revolution is all over the state of New Jersey in all different locations, fueled by craft beer. Come in last place, you could still win brewery prizes. There's a bonus item each week. Make sure to follow Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. This week we have a speaker from the Center for Leadership Studies. Very interesting guy, Mr. Sam Shriver. And we have Biff Hutchinson. You know Biff Hutchinson. No, Biff Hutchinson is basically a professional pogo stick. I guess you say player pogo sticker. But he's in the ex-Pogo League. So very interesting episode, very diverse episode. We talk about a lot of fun things, including illegal organ donation. So very fun episode. Give it a listen and enjoy the podcast.
Hi there. I'm Biff Hutchinson. I'm a professional pogoer, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Yeah, this is Sam Shriver from the Center for Leadership Studies, and you've been listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Let me show you what.
Well, that's kind of funny. Like, I see a lot of kids coming out with their own podcasts, like, you know, a lot of comics on like Facebook and stuff. And then I see them last, like, you know, an episode or two, and then it's over. Mm-hmm. We've stuck with it through thick and thin.
How many did Brian Duffy and.
I don't know. Probably like.
What was it, like 10?
Brian's problem, I think, was. They had like these, the content was huge, and they broke like one episode up into like six parts. It was like, well, just make it separate episode. It was cool. I actually liked it when I listened to it. I think it was too big of. He's doing something now. I think he's got his own thing going now. Gotcha. Like I think it's like Duffified Live is the podcast or something.
Gotcha. But it's one of those things when you meet a girl for the first time, and that first day you talk about everything that's in your life, and then a month later it's like.
Well, I think it comes down to when you realize that like scheduling guests and setting a time that works, it has to be consistent. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And those two guys are busy as hell. Like they're doing stuff all over the country, both of them. So I'm sure it's very hard to set up a set of time. Never mind get an interview. And from our interviews with Duffy, I don't think either of them were tech guys like with audio. So I think it would probably require like a third party to help them out and. The more you add, the more people you add, the bigger project it comes. You know, so we've kept it together here, and
look at us.
So last week was Chef Eric Levine, and the week before that was Dave Andrechuk. So, like I said, we are on a hot streak. If I don't say so myself,
nothing going to stop us now.
Yeah, we are like.
We are
like the Mets. The streak of players getting injured. It does not stop.
The surgeon of the Mets is just racking up. He's like, look at man, I'm buying another yacht.
He is. The Mets have kept doctors in work for years. Do you remember years ago? I don't know if you remember. Ryan Church was one of their outfielders, and he got like a bad concussion in the game, and they sent him on a plane ride to like Colorado, and they basically like almost killed him. They said like the Mets medical staff. The Syndergaard thing, for those of you who don't know, he tore his lat. Now, this will probably be about in a week, so it might be a little, you know, off topic. But he tore his lat because he refused to get an MRI on his bicep and stuff like that. He said he felt fine. And the team said, okay, all right, Berlu, go ahead and throw.
Yay!
You know what? Not thinking that. One, this could be the main guy of your season. Two, it could be the mainstay in your pitching staff for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Three, it's the beginning of the season. You're telling me you're going to let someone just say, no, you know, I feel okay.
And four, you've had injuries to all of your offensive players, all of them.
Offensive players, pitching, you know. After what you went through with Harvey and Wheeler, who are just coming back and just easing back into it, you're going to lose your top gun, you know.
Well, I think your third catcher who pitched during that Nationals game was getting into a rhythm at the end. So
that was hilarious.
I saw that home run he gave up to the one guy who went 6-for-6. It was literally like a softball pitch. It's over the plate. It counts.
It's smart. Why burn the pen there when they're down like 13? I was just like, put him in. Let's see who else can pitch. You know, but the Syndergaard injury is just another thing Mets fans will deal with. They have the worst management of injuries and miscommunication with injuries of any team. That I root for, probably in baseball. They're a joke. They're a joke.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of that's close is the Sixers, where every draft pick magically misses an entire year when they come in. Everything, and all. I sprained my thumb and all. Turns out I have a brain aneurysm.
It's beyond maddening because he's an exciting player. He's must-see TV. Listen, you don't watch the Mets, you watch Syndergaard for a little bit. He's exciting. He's he's big. He's got a personality. You know, like regardless of if you're a big baseball fan or even if you're a fan of another team, he's one of those guys. You're like, whoa, okay. It's like seeing Bartolo out there. He's interesting to watch. You know, or Pedro back in the day was that kind of. Every time he was on, I found him fascinating. Randy Johnson, another guy like you're like, this guy's monstrous and throws a million miles an hour. Like he's fun to watch.
Oh, I love watching him, man.
And the Mets just screw it up. They let the inmates run the asylum again. He says no. You said, all right, well, then you're not playing, and we're going to suspend you. You know, that's it. You know. Yeah, but, well, you know, the Mets have had notorious issues with letting players do what they want, dating back to their best teams, 86 team. You know, that team should have won 4 championships. They were all clowns and never could get it together. Mm-hmm. You know, all cokeheads and animals and... You know, it shows, and it as a Met fan, it's so depressing because there's no excuse anymore. The talent is there. It's win now. We've been waiting for 7 years to rebuild. It's now.
Especially 20 games in, he's still a young pitcher. You just sit back and go, I don't care what you want. We're going to put you under a machine. We see nothing. You're going to pitch again.
Yep.
And we see something, you're going to sit because... We're 20 games in a season. There's 142 to go. Yeah. We already went through this crap last year and somehow figured out how to make the wild card.
Yeah.
I don't want to go through that again.
And my feeling is that this had nothing to do with Terry Collins. I would be surprised if it had anything to do with Sandy Alderson, to be honest. He's Alderson is all about like bringing back guys slowly, and Alderson runs the whole program there. Like, it's his managers, his guys. So I wouldn't be surprised if it came from up top.
He's the GM of the group?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. He's like an ex-Marine, and he's very, like, money ball, and, like, he came from that whole system. Like, he hires coaches that, like, you know, they basically obey him. You know, like, he's kind of the whole thing. I wouldn't be surprised if it's from the good old Wilpon.
Well, I mean, every team we've ever seen where somebody above decides... I'm not the manager, but I'm going to tell you what to do. It never works. You look at the Redskins.
Look at the Redskins.
The owner just kept on saying, no, that 8-time Pro Bowler that's 36 years old, he'll fit right in with this team, and it's going to work. The Raiders with Al Davis.
The modern Cowboys. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always a
disaster. That's the funny thing. Like, Jones has taken credit for, like, Dak Prescott. It's like, no, he fell in your lap.
Yes.
You just lucked out that Romo got injured for the 18th time.
Yeah. I don't know. It's very frustrating as a Met fan to watch this happen over and over and over again. We can't get to see our team, like, always be together, not because of the fault of, like, our medical staff. You know, like, let's keep them together here. But very frustrating. Very frustrating. Makes you want to... I'm going to Noah Syndergaard Hair Hat Day this Saturday.
Oh!
That's the giveaway.
You should come in a sling.
I made a little joke on Facebook. I said, instead of Noah Syndergaard Hair Hat Day, it's going to be Noah Syndergaard Tear Lat Day. Get it? He tore his lat.
Okay.
So, hair hat, tear lat. It's a play on words. You get it? Do you understand it?
Oh, I get it. Words. You use them.
Yeah. We know. You are not... You don't understand words.
Yeah. Just sounds come out of my breath, and apparently it's English.
Yeah, considering, like, we were just scheduling another guest who had a Russian last name, and...
murdered it.
absolutely destroyed
it. This is... a bigger scandal than Trump with Russia and all me attempting to say their last names.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll get it back because he's our guest for next week. So he has a whole week to practice. Yeah. You know? But let's get to one of our guests for this week and we'll talk in a little bit.
All righty.
Susan Robb, who sponsors the podcast and is also, she's gotten us
some amazing guests.
Yeah, I mean, helped us with Andrew Chuck, got us Jim Johnson and Paul Templer. She works for Paul Templer, who, She helped us get... there's a guy named Sam Shriver.
All right.
Now, I think I'm...
She just grabbed a regular guy and said, go interview him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much. That's why I think I'm borderline, like... I think as you get older, you just have to admit that you're getting stupider. Remember I had the case of the dumbs a couple months ago?
Mm-hmm.
So, this guy, Sam Shriver, he works for... He's part of the Center for Leadership Studies. Now... I know he has background in playing sports and playing basketball and stuff like that. But my brain still doesn't comprehend exactly what he does. Okay. So now, like Bob Rathbun, he did a bunch of stuff like this, but we understood that he was the announcer of the Hawks. So Sam, we're gonna kinda tread lightly and figure out what.
We're just gonna bring up random general subjects and just see what he catches on to, and we'll just go with it.
Yeah, so...
So my car is making noises. Any suggestions?
Anything?
No. I was thinking about going fishing this weekend.
What are your thoughts on the election? But anyway, let's give Sam Shriver a call.
Hello, this is Sam Shriver.
Oh, Sam Shriver. It's Scott Brennan here and Michael Berlew. How you doing?
Scott, how Mike? How you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Doing well, sir. Evening?
Sam, good evening.
Sam, where are we calling from? Where are you from?
I'm in Raleigh. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Can you hear us all right?
Yeah, can you hear me? I got you on speaker on my cell. Is that all right?
Yeah, it should be fine. Mm-hmm. As long as we don't start getting feedback. But right now, you sound pretty good.
I'll pick up. Is this any better?
Yeah, that's a little bit better. Less echoey. But yeah, so Sam, you're in Raleigh, North Carolina there?
Yep, Cary, actually a little suburb outside of Raleigh, but yeah.
All right, Sam. Now, I was just saying before we had you on, I've been talking to Susan for a couple weeks now, scheduling you out. And I think, like, maybe there's something wrong with me. I'm trying to figure out what you guys do. It seems like you guys do a lot of stuff, like all with the Center for Leadership Studies, and it's hard to find like a first starting point. So, I know you're part of it, and you got all sorts of different. Even your website just has a whole lot of different things to click on. First off, how would you summarize exactly what it is you do?
I would say the best place to start is that we are the global home of situational leadership. And situational leadership, it's a very well-known, been around for about 45 years model we've trained over 14 million people in it over time, and it's globally accepted. We're in like 35 countries and all that sort of thing. But if there was one thing about the Center for Leadership Studies, it is our Building Leaders program, which communicates our situational leadership model.
Now, the situational leadership, like, are we talking about in business? Are we talking about in just general life? Are we talking about in relationships?
Yeah,
what exactly are we usually working with here?
Yeah, that's a good thing. Like, the overwhelming majority of our customers are corporate customers, people in business, and typically we are positioned at kind of the base of an organization where people are getting their first promotion. So you're a salesperson and, you're pretty good at sales. And so somebody says, okay, you want to move into management? You say, of course, right? And so this would be orientation training for you as you head into management. It's sort of like, okay, here's perspective. You're no longer a technical individual contributor. You're now in charge of other people. You're a player that's becoming a coach for the first time. So how do you coach? What do you do? What are some considerations you should have? That's kind of where we have traditionally been positioned in organizations. But it's a really good point you make. It's like stuff you learn with situational leadership. I mean, these are life skills. They help you as a parent. They help you anytime you're in a set of circumstances where you need to influence other people, it provides you with a perspective or kind of a framework, from which to attack that.
Interesting. Okay. So you still gotta help us out here. All right. So
sure,
I'm a business. Okay. I'm a business and,
yeah.
We are, I don't know, we're a corporate-y kind of business, and we need some help. So why are we reaching out to you guys? What are we looking for? Are we looking to help our employees? Are we looking to send a message to the whole company? Are we looking for an identity? What
What are we coming to you mostly for? And I'm sure you got multiple different reasons, but...
By the way, I love that dog.
Oh, I know.
That barks in the back of your podcast.
Yeah, he's pretty much involved, and he's a third member of the episode, so...
He's a good, Don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes he's the most intriguing part of your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not the first person to tell you that.
Thank you.
I come in a close third.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah.
No, but, I mean, you know, you... You know, it's again a great question. Like, why would you invest in leadership training? Like if you were an organization, why would I want to teach, you know, my managers how to effectively influence other people? Well, you wouldn't, you know, if you really didn't care about turnover. You know, so if retention wasn't a big thing, or the engagement of those employees wasn't a big thing, you know, then maybe not. So, but there's three ways that typically managers are measured. One is productivity. You know, what is it that you can do to accelerate the development of people, you know, in your organization, and or stop their regression? You know, so the whole learning curve thing, are there things you can do as a catalyst, you know, as a parent or as a manager to kind of get people up to speed quicker so that they can be more productive quicker and kind of maintain those levels of productivity? And the other thing, and it's a big buzzword in corporate training, it's you know, engagement. You know, are people giving you, you know, at least a high percentage of what they have to offer? You know, or are they you know, searching for other jobs, or just, you know, complaining about the fact that they don't like what they're doing? So it's results, it's productivity, it's engagement. You know, do I like what I'm doing? And would I consider kind of staying here and continuing my career with this organization? Results, engagement, retention.
What do you usually get more of? Do you get more people who are afraid of, I'm comfortable with this job and they're trying to bring me to the next step? Or do you get more of the, I know what I'm doing, I did this job well, naturally I'm going to be a great manager. What are you trying to teach me here?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think the better you are, and I've seen you've had, you know, various, you know, you've had some coaches and some other things, you know, some people in that line of, you know, in sports on your, you know, on your shows. It's kind of like, have you ever seen a great player that was a crappy coach?
Yes.
Well, you know, it happens all the time. Yeah, it's like the better you are at something naturally, the more gifted a salesperson you are, let's say. Well, the more you don't even think about things, you know, you're just unconsciously confident, you know, when you get in front of customers. And so a lot of stuff like that, it comes naturally to you. But a real good coach can take somebody that doesn't have your natural talent and get them to a level of performance that's, you know, kind of replicates people that have significantly more, you know, God-given talent, so to speak. You know, so that's the typical thing that you try to overcome. It's like somebody was a player, you know, somebody was an individual contributor in an organization, whether you're a, you know, a research analyst or, you know, working in manufacturing or wherever. And it's like you figured out a way to do things and you had a manager that managed you a certain way. And then now you're going to become a manager, you know, so you have one way that you learned. And a lot of problems that people run into is, you know, they try to take their way and make everybody else kind of fit into that. That's what they do, especially when they're under pressure. 70% of the reason you get promoted into management in the first place is because you were good technically. 80% of the reason you struggle or fail is because you don't know how to do things differently. You know, you have one approach that you try to ram down everybody's throat. So the basic bottom line of situational leadership is there's no such thing as a bad approach. They all work. Empowerment works. Giving people direction works. Participating with people works. It's all a question of when you do what, how you read the tea leaves. You know, so you need to identify specific tasks that specific people are going to do and then assess them on their ability and willingness to sort of pull that off and then kind of determine a style that makes the most sense given the task and given the person.
Now, let me ask you something. How does one get even involved in this? And like, I know I heard through the grapevine that you were a basketball player. But how does one evolve from, I guess, a college student and whatnot into, you know, teaching people how to be leaders? Like, and how do you become, I guess you got to become a leader yourself a little bit too before you can teach people anything.
Well, I think athletics, you know, playing sports are a great way to, at a very early age, be conscious of, you know, who good leaders are and who they're not. You know, so as like in youth sports, you know, there are kids that gravitate more towards certain coaches than they do others. And they kind of get a sense or a feeling that's very, very similar, you know, to the sense and the feeling that people get when they go to work and they're working for a bad boss or a good boss. You know, so there's a lot of research that suggests in organizations, you know, people don't leave companies as much as they leave managers. You know, they're just sick and tired of this guy because he doesn't, you know, like he's just not, they're never going to get a chance and they're not motivated. So something must be better someplace else. But sports, I think, is a great way to take a look. And I think those are some of the most difficult leadership coaching jobs there are.
Would you play? Did you play the point? Were you dropping bombs from 3-point land?
I played Division III basketball. So okay. Right away, you know how good I was. I wasn't like a, you know, kind of an NBA caliber, you know, player, even though there was a time where that was obviously a huge dream of mine. And I wound up writing a book that like literally dozens of people outside of my immediate family purchased.
Wow.
It was called From Coach to Coach. But I got to interview guys like, you know, Jerry West, Doug Collins, Pete Newell, cool, Pat Summitt, and just kind of sit behind the scenes with people like that and ask them questions like you're sort of asking me now. Like, so let's talk about leadership. Let's talk about, you know, the way you coach. What's your coaching philosophy? How do you handle superstars? All of those kinds of things. But sports is just a great, you know, sort of, you know, metaphor. And I think it's why so many people are drawn to it. And it's absolutely, if you're coaching major college athletics, for that matter, in this day and age, youth sports. But if you're coaching major college athletics or in the NBA or NFL or something, I mean, every move you make, right, is cut apart 100 different ways. And if you win, you know, wow, look at this. What a genius. If you come up short somehow or some way, it's you've got people that can't even spell basketball that are like, you know, offering opinion on what you should have done differently.
So again, looking at your picture, I'm assuming you weren't throwing down like Sean Kemp type dunks from the foul line.
Mm. Oh, now that's fairly prejudicial.
It's
very rude of you. You're
also an excellent judge of value. You're 100% correct. Yes. I had the body of a basset hound in a game that was meant to go vertical. I did the best I could. Yeah. No, but it was, you're right. I was a 3-point shooter in, a very different game, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. Mm.
Now, as you've been in the sports field, is it an advantage for you to, like, look at how to coach in that since you've been through it? Or is it almost a disadvantage since you have that experience where you might have a singular mindset or even be a little starstruck, like, oh, my God, I'm interviewing this coach, I'm interviewing Pat Summitt? Does it help out or does it kind of push away from you when you were initially going into it?
Yeah, initially going into it, I think it was a big, you know, it was a big help, right? And it's the only reason I got in front of those people in the first place, was kind of access that I had through others to, you know, to coaches of that caliber and also some direct contact, you know. So at the time, it was those folks and they were kind of, you know, helping a kid out. Like, hey, I'm doing this thing. And back at the time, you know, when From Coach to Coach came out, I was just kind of, you know, getting into this field, so to speak. There was far less of, coaches commanding, $50,000 to go give a speech at a banquet someplace. You know, it was almost like the athletic world was separate and distinct from, you know, the business world. I mean, today those things are, you know, very, very greatly. There's all kinds of overlap, you know, but at the time that I was interviewing those coaches to kind of get into sort of the publishing world, if you will. I mean, it was a big advantage, and it provided me some access. And my perspective today, it's sort of like, the beauty or the challenge associated with diversity is a lot of times you get into sets of circumstances where, you know, you're attacking a problem and this is how you're coming from it. You know, right. It's like you have an athletic orientation and it's a team thing. And if you're dealing with somebody that doesn't come from, you know, that or have that base of experience, you have to find some other mutual ground.
Now, let me ask you, you talk to tons of, obviously, a bunch of really influential coaches. Was there one that stands out to you the most, or is there one that influences you the most? Some that blew your mind? Like, is there one that really stands out?
Yeah, I think, he's not as familiar. Like when you said that, immediately the person that popped to mind was Pete Knoll. And not as many people in this day and age are familiar with Pete Knoll. He passed about 4 or 5 years ago, but he was, used to be the general manager of the Lakers. He was most well known as Bobby Knight's mentor. He was the first coach that was inducted into the Hall of Fame for winning an NCAA championship at Berkeley, an NIT championship at Michigan State, and an Olympic gold medal. And at the time, he coached in 1960 what many people thought was the best team that would ever be assembled. You know, it was like Oscar Robertson, Jerry West, and that has since changed. But Pete Knoll forgot more about leadership than most people will ever know. I mean, he was a very quiet, very understated, egoless, kind of person that still had the ability, to just drive people to a level that they never could have got on their own. And he was like a visionary. You know, I remember distinctly at the 1984 Olympic gold medal game when USA was playing China in the Forum in Inglewood, California. And I was standing there with Mr. Knoll, and he pointed to this guy and he says, do you know the new coach at Duke? And I said, no. And he goes, that's Mike Krzyzewski. Never heard of the guy.
Who's that?
And you think about 1984, I wasn't alone there. And he said at the time, just like it was yesterday, he goes, I really think he's going to be one of the next great coaches. You know, he just really has
something,
orientation, and he's learned a lot from Coach Knight, and he's a tough kid, and blah, blah, blah. And, it's like that sort of, he made that call in 1984, and not too many people were, I would say, Pete Knoll stood out, and also Pat Summitt, the women's coach at Tennessee.
I'm sure.
In different ways.
It's funny, like when you talk about coaches like Pat Summitt and like, people, you get the UConn teams that, win hundreds of games straight or whatever. People, they take advantage in their mind, like, it's a two-teamer. They don't understand how much it goes into, one, building a program like that and building it up and then keeping a high standard like that every year. It's not this automatic thing like people are like, UConn's going to – well, they work at it all the time, and Tennessee works at it all the time, and whoever it is, I coach high school sports, but, just to keep even just the high school program a certain way, it's constant work from one year to the next. And people, it's like, you just signed for UConn and they're great. It's not how it works.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And if you think about it, Summitt, she was a head coach at 22.
Yep.
Who watched women's basketball back then? Absolutely no one. And she took, largely on her back, right? And others had to follow, but she was UConn before UConn was UConn.
Right.
And UConn became UConn in large part because of University of Tennessee. But she sort of helped build the sophistication, and the level of play. And you're 100% right. It's sort of like to win once it's unbelievable, right? It's just like the best thing ever. To consistently, year in, year out, have at the high school level, at the college, it probably never happened at the pro level with all of the free agency and stuff. But to, right. to be able to win year in and year out, you're tactically focused. You're strategically focused. I mean, you really have to surround yourself with a great staff that takes care of a number of things, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
Discipline, yeah. especially in college and high school.
Oh, yeah. And you set a tone for that, right? And it's the same thing. That's why so many businesses have so much to learn. And that's why somebody like a Coach K in this day and age commands the price that he commands to go in and talk to corporate America or to, you know, to leaders. But it's a whole different deal. I even think about I grew up in El Segundo, California, which was like a, you know, baseball still is, you know, mega. When I was a freshman in high school, 9 kids that El Segundo put on the field, 5 out of high school went pro and 4 went major college.
Jeez.
And if you in 1971 said, name the future MLB Hall of Famer, George Brett would have been about the 3rd or 4th name you would have picked. He was a great player, no question about it. But there was a guy named John Stevenson who coached El Segundo baseball from 1969 until he passed just a few years ago. He had over 1,000 wins. And you think about that.
In high school.
The guy coaches like 35 years, and that's he's averaging 30 wins a year for 35 years. You know,
that's nuts. It's nuts.
It's crazy. It's crazy. It's a farm system.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm on your site, situational.com, and I'm looking at some of the corporations that you work with. I'm just kind of curious. They're very huge organizations. Do you find that these organizations, when they bring you in to assist, are trying to relay their message or kind of question what your message is, or do you just kind of go into it with your plan on how you motivate and what you look for in people?
Well, you know, the basic tenets of situational leadership that I was talking about before, you know, no such thing as like one best style. You know, like usually when we get together with whoever, you know, whatever corporate partner we have or whatever customer we have, they're really looking in very general terms to build leaders. And, you know, okay, so what does that look like? Well, there's an ongoing series of skills that you take a look at today. And our model is sort of core, common, and critical, right? You know, like a lot of C words there, right? But it's sort of like baseline understanding of if you're going to manage, there is no one best way. And what we do is you're kind of banging around there on our different programs and things, is we tether or connect, you know, our primary program, situational leadership, to other concepts that are equally core and critical. So, you know, we have emotional intelligence, like leading with emotional intelligence, leading teams, leading change. There's a variety of different things, you know, that we profess where you can kind of understand our framework and leverage it to do a variety of different things.
Right.
But most of the customers that come to us, you know, they come to us with a need, you know, to sort of build leaders in some general way. And they really view our stuff as foundational to that journey.
Now, I got a question. So there's a lot of leadership groups out there and different people who come in and do seminars and workshops and things like that. Now, I see you guys have been around for 45 years. Is that correct?
Yeah.
45 years. Now, what makes you guys different and what makes you successful? And it's a two-part question. And as part of being a leader, do you think you also you have to be a learner and also take inspiration from, like, people who are coming up? Like, are you constantly learning, too, as you do this? Like you were saying, like, people without ego and stuff like that. I'm sure, like, when you're always in charge, sometimes, you might be surprised when you learn. Do you find that effect, too?
Yeah, that was 62 questions, and I was hoping that the dog would start barking again so that I could, you know, get a breather.
Well, all right, answer the first 47, and then we'll call you back for the last couple.
And you made fun of us with the dog, so now answer all of them. Go.
Oh. Okay, yeah, here I go.
That's a leader.
See, that's how you lead on the podcast. You lead.
this is a, you know, podcast, like live learning. Okay. Yeah, I like, first off, our founder, Dr. Paul Hersey. Okay, he's a legend in organizational behavior. I mean, he's not, you know, known like, you know, the coach of the Knicks, or and maybe the coach of the Knicks isn't the right way to go in this day and age, but he's an absolute legend. And really what Dr. Hersey did, and this was a weird ballpark 1970, is organizational behavior as a discipline started in, like, you know, 1911. And for the first 50 years, you know, in you know, factory-driven America, right, people were studying leaders on a separate and distinct track from studying human motivation. So there were all these different studies that were kind of searching for the holy grail on leadership. What's the best leadership style? What should leaders do? And then there were all these other studies, like Abraham Maslow's work on the hierarchy of needs, that we're trying to figure out, okay, what really motivates people? How do we distinguish motivation from lack of motivation? Are they the same thing? Are they two separate things? So what Dr. Hersey did is he combined, for lack of a better term, apples with oranges. He said, okay, here is this, you know, the top part of our model is kind of these four categories of different leadership styles that are a function of how much direction you provide and how much discussion or two-way communication support relationship behavior you supply. And again, that's a function of where followers, the people you're trying to influence, are coming from for specific tasks.
Right.
A lot of jargon there, I recognize.
Yeah, you just jargoned me.
It's just sort of like no one best style, and you got to build diagnostics.
You gave me a PowerPoint right there.
Yeah. Pete Newell, I tell you what, Pete Newell, Pat Summitt, Mike Krzyzewski, any kind of great coach. Scott, you know, Patton. What? They have great diagnostic skills. They can read the tea leaves. They can understand, right. Okay, here's what I want this person to do. And here's either I got to back away from this situation and let them figure it out, or I got to inject myself and give them the benefit of my experience.
So why are you guys different?
Well, that is primarily, right. Like Dr. Hersey, that was kind of, he was one of the first contingency models, right?
Gotcha.
So our whole thing is like, you know, it depends, right? That's the first two words you learn when you come to work at our place is, you know, what's the, well, it depends. It depends on the situation and this and that and the other. So that's really sort of a corner, you know, of the market that we have that really has been in existence for about 45 years. And when you think about it, it was generationally and globally relevant in the 70s, and it still maintains, you know, that relevance. And to your point, I think it was question
34. Jerk.
Yeah, yeah. He
totally skipped to 33 point, there.
Right? You know, to your, you know, rough. To your point, you know, to the point about, you know, good leaders, like you absolutely, you know, you learn from the people and you adjust to your set of circumstances. And by design, what that means is that you're absolutely learning from the people that you influence on an ongoing basis. You know, that it clearly is a set of circumstances where successful leaders, especially over time, they adjust, you know, they know when to exert their legitimate power and provide structure. They know when to back off and sort of, you know, leverage their what we refer to as referent power and sort of rely on the trust that they've established with you over time to tell them what's really wrong. Or they just stay the hell out of your way and they let you do what you have proven you know how to do and are motivated to accomplish. So the whole a big thing for us is, does it have global appeal? Well, yes, it does. You know, our model has been, you know, in a variety of different countries. You know, we're in 34 countries as we speak with affiliates. It sort of permeates all of the borders, you know, that are out there. And also big focus in this day and age on generational. You know, do baby boomers and millennials, what do they have in common, you know, when it comes to leadership? Well, they still really want to be treated the way that they need to be treated for the tasks that they're being asked to perform. You know, so, you know, again, in terms of that relevance and in terms of what's going on, that is at least how we, you know, we see it.
What do you think is the number one misconception about good leadership?
The number one misconception about good leadership. And, you know, like when you repeat a question slowly like that, it's primarily because it's a good one and you're a little bit stuck for an answer.
Yeah. But I wish you had a dog now, didn't you?
Yeah. I'm going to invest. I'm going to invest in a dog, and I'm going to start drinking beer, too, after I listen to you guys.
Absolutely. Well, we're sponsored by three breweries.
But I think, like, we describe situational leadership as organized common sense. And I think the biggest misconception about leadership is that common sense is common practice. I think, you know, when you look in the rearview mirror, right, and you are somebody that's not in the moment, you know, making decisions and implementing them with people that work with and for you, it's easy to sort of, you know, sit in the stands and sort of judge, you know, what should have been done. You know, obviously that play didn't work, so they should have done this or should have done that. But common sense, when you're in the moment as a leader and you have all of those individual pressures and personal pressures and pressures from the boss and pressures, you know, to keep your job and all that kind of stuff, you know, leadership isn't as common as we would like to think it is, which is why it's still a topic that so many people gravitate towards. If you can, and we're back to, you know, like one of the other questions that before we got into the last string, it's like our value proposition is that we can help your, you know, managers. We can help people in your organization more effectively influence. What's that worth to you? And in some sets of circumstances, as you've already discussed, you know, depending on the organization, depending on the industry, it might not be worth much. We know turnover is going to be high. You know, people are interchangeable. We'll get them in. We'll leave. To other organizations, it's kind of like, no. We, despite a lot of data that's out there, we want to attract people and we want to keep them and we want to grow them because it is really expensive for us to lose folks that we have trained right on cue. That we have.
There he is. You know, there he is.
People, for us to lose people that we've spent a significant amount of time, effort, and energy training through the first 5 years of their career. So we want to give them every opportunity to stay right here and continue to be productive.
That's awesome. So Sam, before we get out of here, so where can people go to like check you out or get some more information? I think we answered a lot of pretty interesting questions. So where can they go to check you out or say hello and whatnot? And the second follow-up question, no one told me to do this, but is Susan Rom the best thing since sliced bread?
Isn't she unbelievable?
She's,
you know, I mean, it's weird. Let me go second question first here. And the other, let me... Situational.com is our website, and it sounds like you guys have been kicking the tires.
Not to be confused with thesituation.com from the Jersey Shore.
Right.
He's a great leader. I just want to point that out.
Yeah.
When he yells chug at a bar, you chug.
www.situational.com. That's us. And you can also Google situational leadership and we're going to pop up there, the Center for Leadership Studies.
Awesome.
And I, you know, appreciate that. But yeah, Susan, I got to tell you, this may sound weird, but I have yet to be in a room with her. Right. So I have not had, you know, face-to-face opportunity. And, but she is, and I think you guys would confirm this, engaging, asks the right questions, gets people excited through the phone lines. You know, we're very, very excited, you know, to be working with her. And, I mean, looking forward to that relationship moving forward, to say the very least.
Unfortunately,
yeah, she's special.
Unfortunately, Susan, the time ran out, so we're going to have to cut that last couple comments.
Yeah. Last month's check bounced, so. You know.
That is fine, yeah.
Sam, thank you so much, and good luck with everything you're doing. Where are you heading off to next? Are you all over the country, or are you basically in a centralized location?
Yeah, we're headquartered here in Raleigh, but yeah, we go all over the place. And our next big thing is we have a very large conference in Atlanta that I'm going to be attending. But that's not all that exciting, I guess, from a travel perspective. But yeah, we get all over. And I do. I want you to know I do appreciate the opportunity to chat with you guys. And
100%,
through Susan, I was. Introduced to what you're doing, and have kind of spot checked a lot of the different folks that you've had on, and very, very entertaining and very good. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate that for sure.
Yeah. Great time.
Yes. So, yeah, we are back. I don't know where we're back from, because sometimes let's tell the audience the secret, like the behind the
curtain. No.
Sometimes we do interviews before we start, after we start. We sometimes put the first interview, the second interview first, and the first interview second. It gets a little crazy here the Verbal Shenanigans studio.
Everybody knows it's like a magician showing his tricks. Now why will they tune in every week?
It's funny that, like, Obi, we're interviewing these leadership kind of guys, and, like, he knows the dog more than us. He's like, oh, hey, Mike and Scott, right? Oh, there's the dog. I would bet you if you went back and you looked at all the episodes, you listened to him, I would bet you he is in 85% of the episodes. Because a small percentage of the episodes are on location.
All right. So when did you get him? Were you podcasting prior to getting him?
No. No. I got him in 2011. So I started in 13, 14?
2014.
14, yeah, January. I released. But that was my great marketing strategy. I recorded 10 episodes and never released any of them. Instead, I released them all at once. Great marketing strategy.
Yeah, you released one, then you waited 3 months, then you did a bunch of other ones. And
like, yeah, Scott, like, release 10 so people are overwhelmed.
You were like Netflix. You're like, oh, you'll get to the rest eventually.
Yeah, instead of being like, hey, do you like that one? The next one's coming out. I'm like, here's 10 of them I've done. It's pretty great. Yeah. But anyway, that was a long time ago.
If you're driving to, like, the most northern point of Canada, listen to my next 6 episodes right now.
Well, it's funny. That's how I measure my trips. It's like, how many Joe Rogans is that? Like, I'm like, when we were going to Vermont, I'm like, dude, it's 6 hours. That's 2 Joe Rogan episodes.
Two Rogans.
That's it. 2 Rogans. It's like a measurement. It's like miles, kilometers, Rogans, you know?
We're going to have a big party in Texas. Bro, that's like a 4 row, yo. No.
Dude, that's 4 Rogans. I got to fly.
Yeah.
I can't 4 Rogan it, dude.
No.
Can't 4 Rogan it.
When you get about 2.5, you got to get out and stretch, and you're like, oh, what the hell was he talking about?
What do you think is the, what's the limit you can drive?
Well,
I did a drive to Maine, like, not like the border of Maine, like Maine, like all the way up in Moosehead Lake. And that was, I think, the border, like that was like 12, 13 hours.
To Canadians.
That was like 12, 13 hours. And, like, I was done. I could not even focus anymore.
I would say I'm about an 8 to 10 hour range. Yeah. Like when I drove once down to my parents, I did about 8 hours. My sister was still living in North Carolina at the time, so I stopped off there for the night and then went the rest of the way. But
it's I would probably say
I've gone a straight 10 hours.
It's a lot. It's a lot to, like, anytime I drive now, I'm like, oh, maybe we can stop. Like, if I drive far, maybe we can stop here for lunch or somewhere, you know, like,
yeah.
I can't do the straight, like, 10 hours anymore. It's
My dad did, like, when I was, like, 6 or 7, like, my first Disney trip, he just basically woke us up at, like, 2, 3 in the morning, you know, got showered, dressed, got in the car, fell asleep, and then, like, 13 hours later, we're in Florida.
Now, did he order the photo package?
No, they did. This was pre-photo package days. This was the Stone Age of Disney World.
It'd be funny if, like, we go back in your photo albums and you and your dad making that heart.
The heart. Dad, what are we doing? Shut up. I drove 13 hours.
Mom made me do it. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Mike went to Florida recently and he has a girlfriend who loves the pictures, loves them,
and Disney. Double whammy.
It's the double whammy, and he had to take some very unique pictures. We should put the heart picture on the.
I'd be down with that
on the Instagram. But yeah,
The good heart one, not the first one I told you about when I was tired. And I
or
had
the
no first, idea.
Or the second, or third, or fourth.
The 8th one, it brought it back.
The 8th one was the best.
Yeah. It's like, all right, this is why we did this in the first place.
Yeah. I was on Facebook the other day, and some guy posted a website. Okay. And why don't you join?
Great story.
Why don't you join on the, on too, so you can look at this?
All right.
NewDayOrgans.com. New Day Organs. Okay.
Okay.
Now, I saw the site. I actually, like, I was thinking about applying. I have a buddy who works for, like, an organ donation site, like a company, and I thought about applying there because I thought it would be kind of an interesting job and maybe a career change and some charitable work and whatnot. Okay. And I just clicked on it, and I was looking at it. Now, when you click, when you go on the site, newdayorgans.com, it looks like a organ donation site. You know, it looks pretty legit.
I got the stock photo of a surgeon looking down at somebody.
So don't go down too far.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Let's go down together. Okay.
All right.
Let's go down together. All right. So life is a gift. All right. Life is, so that's a nice
one that you deserve, Scott.
Yeah. So why don't you read Life is a Gift for us?
Life is a gift, one that you deserve. So why languish in poor health?
Are you reading it as poetry?
When the poor gift could be
one that you deserve.
Yeah. Okay. When the poor could be used to help you live long and prosper. Our buildings, doctors, and equipment are all top of the line. Our scrub-garbed professionals keep you care as their top priority. They only live to serve. For a hassle-free experience, choose the right medical services. Choose New Day Clinic.
Now, do you notice anything weird about the second sentence in that? So why languish in poor health when the poor could be used to help you live long and prosper?
Okay, I'm seeing.
You see where this is
going to the left right now.
You see where this is turning. Now scroll down with me to About Us.
Okay.
Human organ transplantation. We offer unprecedented access to human organs and tissues, exchanging death for life. Transplantation has
that sounds like the devil. Yeah. That's not a good way to open up your health care plan.
Transplantation has dramatically improved the lives of recipients and enabled them to be active, healthy members of society.
Oh, okay.
All right. So at this point, you're still on board. You're like, okay.
All right. Let's scroll down here.
Confidentiality. Why don't you read that?
All right.
And plus, it makes me get to hear you say confidential.
Yeah, confidentiality. And as I'm about to read this, there's like a heart hooked up to a machine.
In like a Tupperware. Like,
yeah, yep. In like a Pyrex.
Yeah, Pyrex. Well, like, Pyrex like, is good.
Yeah, somebody made lasagna in there before they put the heart in there. So, confidentiality. Our line of work is highly confidential. We believe that our ascertainment of organs is to rid the world of the worthless human being that leech on our society's resource. Each body can supply 7 organs, each freshly extracted when required. We ensure that we give life to those who play a vital role in society.
So now that you read that more like a poem and people have to listen to you read Butcher, if you read it normal, you would
I would have said ascertainment originally.
Yeah. And you would take from it that what's going on here?
They are killing some hobos, for lack of a better term.
Rid the world of worthless human beings that leech on society's resources. Okay, each body can supply 7 organs. So I was like, what the hell when I'm reading it? Now go down.
Okay.
All right, state-of-the-art facilities.
Yeah, all right. And world-class doctors.
Dr. Anton Wright is New Day's Clinic lead transplant surgeon who specializes in kidney, liver, heart, and pancreas transplants, and is co-director of the Life Exchange Research Program, LERP. So it doesn't sound too weird. There's a nice picture.
We LERPed.
No, we LARPed.
Oh, so close.
Your health is worth it. On average, 22 people die each day waiting for a transplant. There's no need to waste any more time sitting on a list. Contact us today, and an organ will be sourced within 1 week.
Oh.
1 week, Berlo.
Oh, none of that waiting.
No waiting. So cut that list in tenths. You know, you go right to the top.
As they cut the living shit out of that hobo.
Yes. Now let's go to the price list.
All right. We're going down.
Okay. So, now, I don't know what the R stands for. Now, I have looked this up.
Rubles?
Look up South Africa's What do they pay for? Rupees? Ruples? Ruples? Rupees? Google. So let's find that out. South Africa
currency.
Yeah. And that's how dumb I was. It took me like 5 minutes to think of the word currency right there.
It's the rand.
The rand. Okay.
The now, African rand.
Can you look up what a rand is? Like how many rands is a dollar?
Yeah, all right. I'm doing it now.
All right.
One, as they call it, czar, is 0.074885 U.S. dollars.
So not a lot.
So about 7.5 cents.
Okay, so one rand is 7.5 cents. All right.
Correct.
All right, so a kidney is 3,545,000 rand.
All right, let me try to put it in.
Yeah, put that in there. Pop that in the Google machine. Boop, 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 get that up in the Google machine. Boop, boop, boop,
boop, boop. It's calculating, Scott.
No, you're typing. You're not even allowed to calculate. All right.
That would be $265,467.23.
Not bad for a kidney. Not
bad. Quarter of a million to have a kidney.
And you sell your house to live.
Now we must keep in mind, Scott, as their asterisks next to the price list, price excludes operation expenses and clinic stay.
That's true. That's true.
So now, that's the fine print. It's all great when they find that person on the street asking for a sandwich and get me a kidney, but you know there's some red tape there.
All right, the liver is pretty affordable. It's 2 million rand. Mm-hmm. The heart's also expensive. It's 1.5 million rand.
Well, why is a kidney more expensive than a heart?
Especially when you have two of them. I don't know.
Yeah. You can live without one kidney. I can't live without my heart.
I don't know, but
because I'm a lover.
Let's talk about savings, Mike. You really want to save and invest in your future?
Of course.
Say your spleen's acting up.
It acts up all the time.
I know. Scott. You know.
You keep on yelling at me.
How many podcasts have we canceled because of your shitty spleen?
Well, you know that's why I figure I get all those cramps during the episodes.
Yeah. So, Berlu, a spleen is only 7,000 rand. For 7,000 rand, you can go get a new spleen.
All right, let me convert this before I approve this. That's like the Jeopardy categories coming up. $524.
$500. Oh. You get a nice, new, well-maintained spleen.
Man, I got
nothing.
I might just buy one as a backup.
Dude, you go away for a weekend, that's $500 easily.
Yeah.
You know, you take a family to a Met game. For 500 rand, you get a nice new spleen. Here's where the savings really start kicking in, Berlu. You know, you got shitty skin, you know. You got shitty skin. It's not working out. You got pimply skin. You need some new skin. Now, for only 140 rand per square centimeter, you get new skin.
That is less than $10.50.
$10.50 for a square centimeter.
Yeah.
Fresh, like beautiful out of the box skin. Lightly worn. Okay. Lightly worn skin. Okay. Yeah. I mean, this place is turning, this is revolutionary, and you go blind, you're doing one of your videos, you know, you're doing pumpkin spice whatever, mm-hmm. You're trying to heat up the pumpkin and the tray explodes and it burns your eyeballs out. Life sucks.
Pumpkin seeds burning my corneas.
Life sucks forever.
No, it doesn't.
Not when you go to the New Day Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
For a small investment of $20,000.
For the pair.
$10,000. So like, say you're struggling for money. Just get one for
$10. Yeah.
A lot of one-eyed guys out there.
That's less than $1,500 US.
$1,500. That, I mean, come on. When you spend that on a vacation.
Easily.
So you get your eyes back for one less vacation per year.
Nice.
I bet you the photo package at Disney was 15 one eyeball. It was one eyeball.
Yeah, it was pretty close.
The heart picture, one less heart picture, you would have had a vision.
For that heart picture, I could have got an actual heart.
Yeah. Now, here's where it gets a little weird, as if it wasn't already.
Well, they have a contact page. We should get them on the podcast.
Yes. I can't find it now. Where's the confidentiality thing?
Scroll up. It's in the middle with the heart.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the whole confidentiality thing, they won't tell you. Our line of work is highly confidential. Okay. Oh, that's why, because you read this as a poem before. They won't tell you where they get these bodies from. Mm-hmm. Now, they do have a number,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought maybe not tonight, but we should call. But this got to be a joke website, right?
I pray. I mean, it's...
But it's South Africa, too, and there's, like, madness going on down there.
It's South Africa. I mean, they're pretty established. It doesn't sound... I mean, if this was, like, North Korea,
no, but maybe. Apparently there's a lot of, like, riots going on down there and a lot of, like, reverse... Like, not even reverse racism. Like, a lot of, like, pushing out of white people and riots and revolts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is, like...
Their way.
And maybe you get a nice white heart.
Yeah, but I'm just worried. I mean, if it's reverse racism, I go in there, it's a black doctor, I wake up, I don't kind of wake up, you know. They just put my stuff in, like, the fridge, you know.
They just throw it in the fridge.
Yeah.
So you're afraid of black doctors, is what you're saying.
South African black doctors. Regular black doctors, I'm cool with.
You're good, you're good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, if I'm about to go under, I'm like, yo, what's your nationality?
Yeah. But, like, the site starts out nice, and then it just slowly, like, tumbles into, like, insanity. So maybe,
this is, like, the purge.
Yeah, maybe we should put it says contact us.
Yeah.
Call us to schedule. You know what? Let's see what... Let's just see what happens when
Well, that's... I think that's a South African toll-free number.
You know what, though? We have some sponsors. They can pay for the...
Thank you, Demented Brewery.
thank you, Demented. No.
You want me to read some poetry while you're down there?
No.
Just call me Haiku Burlu.
Let's just see what pops up.
If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911.
It is.
If it was an emergency, I want New Day
Clinic.
Hang
up and dial 411. For difficulty making or completing calls, hang up and dial *611. Oh. For alternate billing of a call,
All right. Yeah. So,
well, like I said, I mean, that looks like a South African toll-free number, which can only be dialed in South Africa.
I mean, I feel like it's just...
If this is an emergency... Yeah.
We know.
I feel like it's just... I feel like it's a joke site. It's got to be. We harvest organs.
Doug, we paid for a trip to you for Africa. We just need you to go to one place for us.
I mean, I don't know.
Then you'll be back on the podcast.
I don't know. I don't know, man. Kind of creepy. We'll share the link on the on the Facebook. New guest. We got a guest coming.
Oh, it's 8:30, yeah.
Yep. Brother, why don't you do this?
Well, as our...
Do something.
As our audience knows, we've recently gone through a bunch of different extreme
crime
athletes.
In the bathroom.
No, well, they're not supposed to know about that.
No.
Scott, you got to edit that out.
Sorry.
But we've been looking at some different extreme athletes from the Red Bull Sports, and I went to another level here. So who's coming on our show is a gentleman by the name of Biff Hutchinson.
Oh, my God. I love the Back to the Future movies so much. They're my favorites.
Scott, it's not him.
Oh.
He did not use the flux capacitor to bet on sports.
It's not Biff. All week you told me we got Biff on.
Yeah, I was wondering why you're so excited. I guess I should have explained.
This is a big letdown.
But no, hold on.
All right.
Biff Hutchinson is a part of X-Pogo stunt team, and he actually has world records for what he does on pogo sticks.
On pogo sticks?
Yes.
I got the pogo stick. Okay. All right. I'm in. Mm-hmm. I am in. Let's call Biff Hutchinson.
Boop, 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 boop.
No, we're ringing. We're not on Skype. Try to avoid. Well, I don't know which one's better. Skype seems to have more technical issues. Phone. If they're not from America, they charge me out the wazoo.
Hello?
Biff, what is up, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, this is Scott Brennan and Mike Burlew here from Verbal Shenanigans Podcast.
Well, sorry. What were your names again?
Oh, I'm Scott, and this is Mike here.
Evening, Biff.
Scott and Mike. All right.
Yeah. I was just telling Mike I'm a little disappointed. He told me Biff was coming on all week. I thought it was Biff from Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get that a lot.
I know.
That was the, yeah, thanks for reminding me of that joke, Scott.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I've been doing that. I've been getting that joke since kindergarten. Shut up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But Biff, where are we calling you from? Where are you at right now?
I'm at my house in Burley, Idaho.
Idaho. Mm. Which explains why you became a pogoer.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Well, let's get into it slowly here. All right. So you're part of a stunt team now, but first off, I remember pogo sticks being very intimidating as a kid. Like I was always like afraid of like just you know eating it over and over again. I saw kids who can do it, but pretty much the general public couldn't do it. When did you first ride a pogo stick?
Well, I got, like a lot of kids, I got a traditional pogo stick when I was maybe 10 or 11. And that was just your standard spring pogo stick. And I was kind of always into extreme sports as a kid. I was doing a little BMX. I live out, for a little context, my hometown had 170 people. So
wow.
There really wasn't much to do unless you were out doing it. So kind of adventurous. And then, when I got my first pogo stick, about 10 or 11. And, yeah, it just, for whatever reason, my friends had them, and they'd jump for a little bit, and then they'd end up in the garage.
But wait. So you had friends who had a bunch of pogo sticks. So you were, like, initiated into the pogo gang.
Kind of in a way.
They didn't have drugs in Idaho, so that's what the gangs did.
It was either potatoes or pogo.
Both
very
began
limited.
With a P.
Very
so.
Limiting.
Yeah, well, I had one friend in particular that had one, and he just kind of brought it out kind of as a gag, and I got on it, and I really liked what it was like, and I picked it up fairly quickly, and then just the uniqueness of the fact that no one else was doing it kind of drawed me to it, and
totally.
It's kind of why I stuck with it.
Now, what age did you pick this up?
That was probably 11 years old.
Wow. Okay. All right. So you start on this pogo stick. Now, are you just in the backyard just seeing how many pogos you can do? I don't know if that's the right term, or jumps you can do. And where does it start to slowly evolve into what we're seeing today on video, the more extreme kind of thing?
Well, for me, it never was about how many jumps I could do. And I've never even officially gone out and counted, because I had friends that were skating and doing BMX. And so kind of coming from that background, I wanted to put those tricks and see if they were possible on a pogo stick. And and I tried that for maybe 6-8 months, almost close to a year. And then one day I kind of was looking it up on the internet, you know, on Ask Jeeves, and all of a sudden this website called xpogo.com showed up, and it really was a really small community of about 10, 12 people across the country on these little pogo sticks that were doing tricks. And that's kind of when I realized, oh, this is a legit thing. I'm not the only one in the world doing these tricks. And that's kind of what progressed the sport and shaped it into what it is today, for sure.
That's interesting. Now, what made you want to stay on the pogo stick? I mean, you're saying you were going through biking and pogo sticking. What made you want to stay at that level and then go to the next step?
I think it was just just my curiosity, really. At the point when I was starting out, really we were inventing all the tricks that you'd see today, and back then everything was pretty low to the ground, so you had to be pretty creative. But just the uniqueness factor that no one was doing it, and the kind of the thought that I can, you know, try and figure out these tricks in my head and see what works and what doesn't work, and just being one of the first people, the first wave of the people doing tricks, kind of kept me hooked, you know, watching the progression and keeping up with it and whatnot.
Now, how old are you now, Biff?
I'm 22, turned 23 in a couple of weeks here. So.
Oh, okay. So you said you started around 11. So you have over a decade of pogoing in your, I don't even know what you say, under your belt, I guess. you have a lot of pogoing on you. Now, did you find, tell us about when you actually joined what you call the community of pogoing and whatnot, and when did it start to actually evolve into like a thing that you could do? I see you guys have traveled different places and open up, I see halftime shows and stuff like that. When did that actually become like an actual thing? Like, okay, I'm not just like this guy in Idaho jumping on a pogo stick.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting question because it was kind of dependent on the technology for a very long time. The spring pogo sticks were getting maybe a foot off the ground, foot and a half if you were wide enough. And so soon enough, companies like Vertigo and Flybar started making the big pogo sticks. And that's kind of when those came out, that's when I decided that that's kind of what I wanted to pursue. And so when I was around 13, I got a Flybar, which uses these huge rubber bands. And people were getting 3 or 4 feet. And that's when people started doing backflips and front flips. And I was kind of aspiring to be at that level. And then when I was 14, I got my first Vertigo. And that's what you see everybody using today. It's a compressed air pogo stick. It's super versatile, pretty indestructible, top-of-the-line stuff. But I got my first Vertigo, and through this time, I'd been kind of trying to make a name for myself in this slow but steadily growing community of pogoers around the country. And every year, there's a world championship. It started out, it's called Pogopalooza, and it started out in Nebraska in a parking lot, and then it kind of had its ups and downs. And by the time I was 14, going on 15, I decided that, you know, I've been doing this for long enough. I want to go meet all these people for one, and I want to kind of do the competition deal. So Pogopalooza 6 was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was 2009.
Did you say Pogopalooza?
Pogopalooza, yeah. That's the world awesome. Championship. And, yeah, that was my first time meeting all of my peers now, and my first time competing. And I was, you know, I come from a small town in Idaho, and now I'm in Pittsburgh, so decided to give it all I had and entered the pro competition and ended up winning the professional big air competition when I was 14. And then that's kind of when the door started to open for me. I got a sponsorship out of the deal, and Pogopalooza 6 itself got a lot of hype around the sport. So after that, there was an endorsement deal with Kangaroo Shoes. I don't know if you guys remember those. Had a deal with them for a little while. Yeah, Shoes with Pockets. And then we did America's Got Talent. That was probably 2010, 2011. And the steam kind of started to build, and we kind of rode that momentum for all it's worth. And I think that's kind of what we're still doing, just on a bigger scale now.
Yeah, I mean, bigger scale meaning us, the podcast. Yeah, I mean, you guys really made it here today.
And when you guys were...
Yeah, this is a new height.
Oh, I see what you did there. Oh. New heights.
When you guys were in the competition, what is being judged? Is it the exact height itself? Is it tricks with a judge? Are there different categories?
Yeah, there's three main disciplines. There's big air freestyle, and that's kind of the all around competition. There's obstacles, there's boxes and platforms to jump off of and onto, and you're judged on your creativity or use of the course, and it's over a 90-second time. And then there's the traditional high jump, like you see, you know, in track and field, where there's just a high bar. If you hit it, if you knock it off, you're out. If you clear it, you move on. And then there was a best trick competition as well, which is kind of the new tricks that never been landed before, the tricks that are really pushing the sport.
Now, let me ask you something. So, one, your family, your parents or whoever, whatever, when you said you're like, I'm going to be a professional pogo guy, that's how I imagine it went down. But
that was a good Biff imitation, yeah, by the way.
I'm going to be a pogo guy, joining some stunt. Did they look at you like you were crazy? And two, the second thing is, obviously you guys are pushing the envelope a lot. What's the worst injury you suffered from doing this?
Ooh, those are good questions. For the first one, I mean, I was always kind of crazy, just in general. I rock climbed a lot as a kid, and I was kind of into BMX and just the adrenaline sports in general, so I don't think it was much of a surprise when they saw me trying to take those tricks to a pogo stick. And I'm lucky enough to have a really supportive family. My mom and dad and my sisters really pushed me, and they were very supportive of me, which ties into the injuries. I would say pogoing is a fairly safe sport in that you have no, FMX, like motocross jump. They're jumping, 70 to 100 feet regularly, and that's very high consequence. Where pogoing, we have no forward or backwards momentum, which is good, and it's also bad because every time you fall, you're falling, 8-10 feet straight to flat, so you can't roll out of it.
Right.
So you get a lot of ankle injuries and knee injuries. I think I've broken both my ankles 3 times.
Wow.
Broken my feet, my toes. I'm up around 20 broken bones total, but I think my worst was, it was right after Pogopalooza 6, so right after I kind of had made a name for myself, and there was an opportunity to do the Conan O'Brien show.
Really?
And they were going to fly me out. Yeah, it was kind of a big deal. They were going to fly me out,
yes.
But they needed me to do a I was excited, I'd never, that'd be my first performance. But I was training for it about 2 or 3 days before, and they wanted me to do a backflip with a full twist. And it's something that I had just learned the week before. And so I was really nailing it and trying to drill it, but I didn't have an idea of how to do it right. And I came down wrong, and I come down still spinning. My toe catches a little dip in the grass, and I basically spun around on my leg, and it did a full 360. I broke my ankle, my tibia spiraled from my ankle all the way up to my knee, and my fibia got busted into 3 or 4 pieces.
Wow. And you know what sucks about that? You can't be like, at a bar when they're like, what'd you do? You're like, yeah, pogo injury. You have to really explain that, You can't.
right. Yeah, exactly.
You get like, some girl's not going to be like, oh, man, that guy got injured doing pogo. You really got to get show them a video.
Yeah, exactly.
Then they're like, whoa, okay.
No, seriously, I was going to be on Conan.
Yeah, sure you were, pogo boy. Buy me a drink.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
Right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the ex-pogo stunt team, like who runs it and how they go about getting to these events?
So the ex-pogo stunt team kind of is a derivative of the company ex-pogo, which comes from the original ex-pogo.com, which was kind of the meeting place, the chat room for all the pogoers back in
the
day.
What, the chat room for pogoers?
Well, yeah, there was it was not necessarily chat room.
Like, hey.
There was a forum.
What are you doing, pogoing?
Age, sex, location, pogo stick.
ASLPS.
Not as much ASL, but there was, there was a forum topic for, these new pogo sticks are coming out, a forum topic for...
It'd be funny if you guys were cyber pogoing, .. boing, .. boing, .. boing. Sorry.
So
I get off track sometimes.
No, you're fine. After that forum, that's kind of where we laid the groundwork. That's how Pogopalooza was organized, just talking back and forth. And that eventually turned into a company in 2012 when there became a greater need for for pogoing and performances, that kind of outlet opened up.
Hold on one second. Let me quiet this big pooch down. I'm sure you hear him. Hold on.
He's good.
Oh, that's the sushi that got delivered.
That's how professional we are on the podcast. We get sushi delivered in
here.
Well,
everyone thinks that like we're in like a studio or something. Yeah. We're in my house with my dog, and he's always here. I can't put him.
Oh
in
yeah,
here. Yeah. So now my girlfriend is talking to the sushi delivery woman.
I'm looking outside right now.
Yeah, we're just waiting for the door to close.
I'm not sure what Biff's doing.
All right, sorry, Biff. Go ahead. Sorry, brother.
Oh, so, yeah, just back to the formation of the stunt team. When, like, after America's Got Talent, some companies took notice, and we started being able to do various TV shows. Guinness World Records kind of took notice, and they formed a deal where the people that were running the company X Pogo could adjudicate Pogo records, and that kind of opened up to we could pitch, hey, like, for instance, we did the Today Show, and we did the highest front flip world record on their show. I've done world records in Brazil, China, and all over the place, so that kind of opened up some stuff. And the X Pogo Stunt Team, as it is now, is it's kind of the group that... So X Pogo, the company, does the sales. They'll do all the logistics work. They'll get flights. They'll get hotels and lodging set up with the client, and then they'll call me or I think there's about 20, 25 other guys that travel. They'll call us up and see if we're available and then line up the flights and gigs, and we go do what we have to do and come back. So it's a pretty slick deal.
That is amazing. Like, and let me ask you something. Like, are you able to live off of pogoing, or is it's still kind of like a side hobby, like work kind of? Like, yeah, I do this on the side.
Yeah. Well, definitely in my younger years, it was my only source of income, and you know, I had no responsibilities. Now I'm kind of more or less settled down. Got married a little while ago, so I do it a little less. There are guys that it's their sole profession, and for me, it makes up a huge chunk of my income. I do side jobs here and there, right. But no, it's definitely a huge factor.
That's awesome. Now, when you met your wife's father, like, were you like, yeah, I want to take your daughter's hand in marriage? And he's like, what do you do? You're like, yeah, I pogo. And was that a difficult situation?
Well, that's the beauty of living in a town where everyone knows each other, because I was already a pogo kid that everybody saw jumping around. So
Biff's been jumping for years.
So let me, I'm looking at some of your videos here, and you had the world record for the highest jump. What was that, 11 and a half feet it was?
That's actually disappointingly misleading. It's 11 feet half an inch.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it, man? All right, we got to end this interview.
Yeah. But I guess my question is, like, how much do you have to train to get ready for that? What was your starting point to get up to that world record?
Like, it kind of goes back a long ways. I was pretty scrawny as a kid, and so I didn't necessarily always have the body weight to get the height you need, because there's a ratio of how much pressure. Obviously, the more pressure, the higher you're going to go, but since I was really young, I always trained at a very high pressure. And so because to do some of the tricks, you have to do two or three movements in the air. And I'm kind of clumsy, so I'd have to jump higher to compensate for not being fast. So I kind of started jumping high at a young age, but I was always terrible at high jump. During competition, from Pogopalooza 6 on to 10, I didn't place at all. And then at Pogopalooza 10, I broke the world record. I think that was 9 feet 7 inches, or it was 9'6", and I did 9'7". And then after that, I kind of I decided that I kind of wanted to switch from. I was more of a big air guy back then. I kind of wanted to work on high jump, and so just years of training that and developing different techniques. I've had two or three different techniques through the years. to prepare for the 11-foot jump, that was actually quite a bit of work. I made those standards myself, and then spent a lot of time positioning. I think if you're seeing the video, I hop off the tractor, and that's just to conserve energy, because when you have – normally people would jump at about 70 PSI, but for that record attempt, I was at 160. So wow. Just to initially get that going is a lot of work, and – it's possible to do off the ground, but it was me and a buddy trying that record, and we tried for 2 hours. So
that's
that
awesome.
Tractor position was definitely important to keep me a little energized and just kind of mapping that place out. That was over at my grandfather's place. Quite a bit went into that record, a lot of training, a lot of work.
I look at the pictures. You've been all around the world. What was the coolest place to perform your stunts at?
I'd have to say Rio de Janeiro. I was down there for 11 days. I did a world record shoot, and I was in Sao Paulo for another 4 days. And it was incredible. Jeez. I was right out of high school. Mm. Down in Rio, you know, living the life, shooting a pogo video, pretty carefree. So that was definitely a highlight.
Mm. Now, let me ask you, the sport of pogo here, we're obviously not even into the, into the what it could be or where it's going. Where is it going? And you guys are probably the ambassadors of the sport because there's not much out there for it. Where do you see it going? What do you hope to see? And what are your future plans with this?
Well, that's kind of the question that me and my friends are always asking ourselves is this worth it? Because, you know, the payoff, it's been steady, and we've been I'm continually seeing on Instagram people posting that I didn't know even pogoed. I went from knowing everyone in the world that was doing this extreme pogo stuff to now there's, you know, a couple hundred kids, maybe even close to 1,000 that I have no idea. That's obviously nothing on the scale of scootering or skateboarding or BMX, but I definitely hope that through these performances, we did a lot of school tours for a long time, trying to kind of get to the, you know, junior high level kids, get them inspired. Right. And, my end goal is to see it be, you know, as big as scootering or BMX skateboarding, be kind of a mainstream sport. And that's kind of what I've dedicated my time with Pogo to do. I do all the local elementary and high school shows around here, and I'm always trying to spread the word because I just think that it would be really amazing in 20 or 30 years if me and, you know, the 10 or 15 guys that I grew up in the sport with were the Bob Burnquist, the Tony Hawks.
When they do that documentary on Pogo. Biff Hutchinson.
Yeah, 30 for 30.
Yep. Yeah.
Pogo. That's the long game. That's the long game for sure.
So can you see this sport going into something like the X Games or getting Red Bull involved or something like that?
I definitely think that the potential's there. I just think that that there just needs to be more exposure. And that's slowly coming all the time. There's always more features. There's always, you know, we're doing television shows and
right.
performances all summer long, and the NBA halftime circuit helps a lot. But yeah, I definitely hope to see it become an X Games level sport. Just kind of a widely accessible thing because unlike, you know, BMX or mountain bikes, you can spend easily $1,000 or up to $10,000 on a good downhill mountain bike. And for the best pogo stick in the world, you're spending a little over $400.
Mm.
So it's got that accessibility and it's also got the excitement factor. And, I think one of the cooler things about pogoing is you don't need any setups. Like if you're wanting to BMX, you have to find a spot or you have to have a ramp or a skate park.
Right.
And pogo is actually perfect if you just have flat, hard ground, which opens up a lot of obstacles and features for us to hit that other sports can't particularly hit without a lot of setup, which I think is pretty appealing in the action sports world. So it definitely has its unique advantages as well.
Very cool, man. We've interviewed a lot of like like Red Bull athletes with the kayaking and the piloting and wake surfing recently. I wouldn't put it past you if you keep working on it and keep doing what you're doing. Something's going to crack into the mainstream, or not even the mainstream. We're in a day and age where there's a niche audience for everything. So we wish you the best of luck with everything you're doing. If people want to go check out your videos or see what's going on with this, or they're a little bit interested, where should they go?
If you want to check my stuff out, you can hit me up on YouTube. It's YouTube. You can just search Biff Hutchison. I've got a ton of videos on there. Or I'm always on my Instagram. That's Pogo Biff. P-O-G-O-B-I-F-F, my handle.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for coming on, and we really do wish you the best of luck with the Pogo stuff.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that.
All right. You ever ride a Pogo stick? I was all like, I tried it like 4 or 5 times. I'm like, nope.
I somewhat have memories. I can't say like I was constantly on the Pogo stick.
You mean in general?
Yeah.
I somewhat have memories.
Yeah, I have 10 memories. One of them happens to be Pogo sticking.
Here are my 10 memories. Wait, where am I?
Oh, crap. Now I lost one.
One got pushed out from that interview.
No, I don't know where I live.
I mean, it's pretty fascinating. It's funny because even like some of the people I message or email to try to get on the show, like one I just emailed a guy who he just like straps, like he's basically doing his own like Jackass on Instagram, and he's like,
okay,
crushing it. Like the guy like puts like firecrackers all over himself, lights in, like he drilled into his ear, all these dumb things.
It never gets old.
But
if you hurt yourself, people will love it.
Never gets old. Never.
It's impossible.
Never.
Like 3,000 years from now, when the robots take over the world, they'll still have humans around to do the Jackass stuff.
Absolutely. But they just get dented and stuff.
You will jump off a cliff.
I am Johnny Knoxville. This is Robot Jumping. But anyway, let's take a quick break and we'll get the hell out of here. All right. So I did. I got a call this weekend.
Oh, you crazy man! You.
I got a call this weekend. Someone from work was like, "You run comedy shows?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, if I get asked to do them, I can do it."
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, "Oh, it's a firehouse. It's a fundraiser." I'm like, "Yeah, no problem. I've done them now. I'm pretty experienced, I guess. Not that it's more
you
running
just
the
throw
show
it out there."
But anyway, So she's like, yeah, she's going to be contacting you relatively soon. I'm like, okay, no problem. She calls, leaves a message like, oh, we'd love to do something for the firehouse, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, cool, fine, another show, you know, get the name out there. And she calls me. I finally call her back. Like, it took 2 days to get back. And she's like, yeah, got your name from blah, blah, blah. And we'd love to do something. I'm like, perfect.
That's how it works.
She goes, we got a beefsteak coming up. I'm like, okay. Well, it's probably going to be a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, it's a beefsteak and bingo night. I'm like, okay.
Like,
All right.
I got to be honest. Like, in the comedy world, the first word beefsteak is already like,
exactly.
Okay.
It's a swallow. Like,
oh, now bingo is involved.
Well, that Dover Fireman show I did was 3 hours of beefsteak, which means 3 hours of firemen drinking.
How big is that cow that they're cooking up?
300 firemen drinking. They'd be like, okay, sit still for an hour and a half for the comedy show. The comedy show should have been 24 minutes. Like, here's your comics. Goodbye. You know, like, they didn't give a shit. They just wanted to come out. But, so she's like, yeah, it's a beefsteak and bingo. I'm like, oh. So she's going to say beefsteak, bingo, and comedy show? I'm like, okay, that seems like a lot. She goes, no. She goes,
there's a twist.
I wanted someone to, I heard your comic, to, you know, to read bingo, call bingo, but maybe spice in some jokes, maybe some adult humor in there. I'm like, ew. Like, wait. I'm like, so what do you mean? Like, she's like, you know, like she'd call numbers and you just throw
like a dirty joke in there. And then her literal words were, how funny would that be? And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, pretty funny.
How many numbers are in bingo? I forget, like 89?
Yeah.
Well, so you need 89 separate jokes.
Well, I mean, like,
not counting every new game.
I even made a post. I'm like, oh, yeah, the hilarity that would be like when I said, oh, I 69. B-18. She B-18. She better be.
Before what?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I'm like, no matter what date she sent me, I would have been booked. I was like, oh, what date are you looking for? She's like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't. But people, stop trying to cram comedy where it doesn't belong. Yeah. We would rather not do it than just shove it into the back room or shove a comedian. And that was funny. I'm like, oh, I could ask around. And she's like, no, you're the one we want. I'm like, no, yeah. I think I'm booked that day.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
The old people who come to bingo only want to hear the letter and the number. I got to be brutally honest.
I love that they're like, yeah, you know what would make this bingo better? Dick jokes.
Nothing like 70-year-old women
first off,
full of beefsteak.
Bingo isn't bad enough. Like, do something different than bingo. It's 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo, like, let's get rid of bingo. Let's do anything other than bingo. Bingo is antiquated and old.
When I was in North Carolina, I was at a brewery that did, like, music bingo. So it would play the song. You had to know what it was and then mark your thing. And then if you actually got five songs in a row, it's a bingo.
Speaking of that, big things ahead.
That's why you did the drum roll.
Hopefully. New Jersey just got rid of its laws where breweries are now allowed to have live entertainment.
Ooh.
So the comedy...
Scott, we know breweries.
The comedy craft beer flight is in the works. And we'll talk about that another time.
Nice.
Just dropping a little hint ski there. What do you got?
What I got? Well, a couple things. One thing, I've been trying to, like, as you know, I always look up doing different things and want to try stuff out and kind of face some things.
That's a gender thing. I'm totally in support of you.
Yeah, that's, we say that for AJ, you know.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right, I forgot. Don't different spoil. Episode. Different episode. Yeah, different episode.
But, I've been kind of on the fence as looking at it. So, I have a farm that's, like,
you have a 12, farm?
12 minutes away from me.
You have one? You have a farm?
Yeah.
I don't see you as the farming type.
No. I'm the kind of type that's like, I don't feel
I
like
I can see you as the guy yelling at the people at the farm.
Yeah.
Like, to work harder.
I'd be the guy that wakes up at 6 in the morning like, nah. Cabbage will grow on its own.
Just overgrowth of cabbage and weeds. Welcome to the Burloo Farm. You find it, you bought it.
Yeah. They're doing a beekeeper seminar.
All right.
At this place.
Oh, I know a guy I work with. His dad, him, and his brother are now beekeepers.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
So I've been kind of looking this, and there's a part of me that kind of wanted to do it on the stance of, I am petrified of bees.
Oh, that's right.
And it's kind of a thing where I want to kind of face it. Try to get through this and go through the experience.
Why don't you do a video of it? Like, before.
And that's the thing. My other concern is I do it and I'll be crying as I see bees around me. And, like, I see one bee.
Do you want hits? Or do you want to be, like, yeah, this is pretty okay? And you get four hits.
Hey.
Crying is thousands of hits.
Don't knock pumpkin spice whatever, okay?
You weren't afraid of pumpkins.
That'd be great, though. Why am I doing this for 31 days? They're so orangey.
They're so rough on the exterior, but smooth on the inside.
So there's a part of me that wants to go through this, but I kind of know me in the sense that the second I see one, like, flying around me, I'm going to be, like, Stonehenge. I'm
now, can we arrange iPodcast? I do like a solo show while I watch you, interview you previous.
It's May 13th if we want to contact the farm.
I can't do May 13th.
What the hell are we going to do?
What if we contact the farm and see if we could do a separate thing where there's not people there?
Well, they list the beekeeper on there. Maybe we can get the beekeeper.
Is that like the gatekeeper?
I don't know.
Her name is
Janet Katz, and she's apparently the president of the New Jersey Beekeeping Association.
I'm glad you're promoting the beekeeper.
Well, we're talking about it.
Her name is Janet Katz. She used to be a secretary down in Milltown, but she moved up here to pursue her beekeeping
dream. She's our president of beekeeping. Don't make fun of her.
Okay, we will contact her for sure. Okay, okay. We should probably see if we could do like a separate thing where you
face my fear.
Face your fear. I cast before, after, and during. Mm-hmm. We interview her. That'd be a great episode.
I'm down. I'll try to find her.
Instead of broadcasting the audience. Her name is Janet Smith.
I'm trying to keep the conversation going.
Beekeeper seminar at Alfstead Farm.
Do you want me to say it in poetry form?
Can you?
All right. This course will take you through everything you need to get started. Equipment, hive location,
all right, I'm
breed done. Selection, biology, pest and disaster control. Seminar participants
we
will
need, we need some best in disaster control here. Anyway, you had something else too, right?
Before yeah.
Before we get the hell out of here?
I was up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania this yes. weekend. Had to work.
Whips, baby.
Yeah. 18-hour day there. So I was up there Friday night. I'm stressed out getting ready for the work prior to the Saturday work.
Right.
So let's start off with that. So my lovely lady Isabel, she's driving up, and she calls me like every 20 minutes crying that she missed a turn, and she has no idea where she's at.
In the age of GPS.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. She uses the phone, and she didn't know how you, after you accept a call, can go back to maps. So there was one point where I was calling her just trying to say, okay, tell me where you're at, try to work you out. The second I called her, she's like, the maps are gone! Stop calling me! I can't look at the map! If you keep calling me, I missed my turn 8 times, and I don't want... I'm like, you want to just meet me up at work? Whatever. And she called up on me.
Jeez. It's like when my dad asked me, he's like, did you text me? I'm like, text? He's like, yeah, you know, text. I'm like, text you? Like, he's like, text, like T-E-X. I'm like, dad, there's a T in there. Text. Just shot. No, no understanding.
I don't understand your crazy Largan there, boy.
Do you say Largan?
Yeah.
Did you mean jargon?
Jargon, Largan, they're both in there.
But I heard that Largan's a little bit different than jargon.
Not really. I mean, it's more of a West Coast jargon, you know, right, based out of L.A. That's why they call it Largan.
Did you just Largan? Did you say I heard the Largan?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Well, I did in your dad's voice, so you call your dad and ask him why he's...
Why do you think that every voice you do is your dad? Yeah. This is your dog's voice. This is your dad's voice.
Uh-huh.
As soon as you put your stamp of approval, that's it. That's how they talk.
That sounds good.
That's their Largan.
I don't care if they don't do it. That's them.
This episode is going to be called A Lot of Largan. Jargon.
Jargon, yeah.
Okay.
So
they're explaining their Largan.
Kill the Largan.
So
it's
much
like an
Largan.
Octopus with like 12 octopi on it, you know.
Wait, so it's
I don't even know.
It's wait,
like,
so it's an octopus with more octopuses on it.
Yeah.
I'm not even touching that one.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't.
Octopi with octopi on it.
That's how we roll.
All right, tell us more about the Largan.
Yeah.
And let's see if this bit even stays.
No, let's keep on going
right,
with
go.
Isabel.
Let's go. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. So a hour and a half drive, that took her like 4 hours. So she's...
4 hours.
Yeah, so she's near tears anyway. She has to come to me while I'm at work and basically stay there for another hour before we go back to the hotel.
And we all know you're very happy at work.
Yeah, I am a very pleasurable, enjoyable person at work, you know. I should have got more hints from our first guest on how to leadership in our place. But so we try to get back to the hotel. Construction's happening, so it took us like an extra 15 minutes to get back to the hotel. We get to this hotel. It's like an extended stay somewhere in Wilkes-Barre. Right off the bat, the parking lot and the elevator reeks of pot. Like, not just, hey, somebody lit up something. Like, a gang of people just...
Just a gang of reefer smokers.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Stuff we feared in 1920.
Right. Reefer madness. Okay.
So right off the bat, that's nasty. Then we get into the room, and we're trying to get ready. We're going to meet up with some friends. I'm getting dressed as I'm like in my underwear. I'm trying to grab for my clothes to change into. As I pull my suitcase over, all of a sudden I see a wasp in there.
You brought the wasp with you?
I gotta think it's in the room.
You never pack your wasp. Every time I ask you when we go away,
I put it in my wallet?
You're like, I don't want to bring them, but you brought it for Izzy. What? Great story. You're awesome.
Well, you know, you take my wasp away, it comes back, it's dirty.
You bought your friendly wasp. Brought him.
Well, he wasn't my friendly wasp, but he was his evil brother.
Okay, so you opened it up, a wasp came flying at
him. I don't even know where it came from. Like, I pulled over the luggage, and all of a sudden, there's a wasp on our sheets. So I panic, and first thing I do is I grab whatever I can to kill it. So obviously, Izzy had clothes on the bed, and I killed the... Oh, there's a song going on.
It's by Wasp.
Oh.
Oh.
I wasn't a fan of Wasp.
No one was.
They just existed.
But anyway, tell a story with Wasp.
So I killed the Wasp. So now she's freaking out at me. She's like, of all the things you could have grabbed, you grabbed my clothes to kill the Wasp. I'm like, it's the first thing there. I would have grabbed my mother and smashed it into the wasp.
Right away, this just sounds like a tired, grumpy argument. Like, you grabbed my clothes. Like, in the situation, you were reacting like you were saving her from, like, a primordial beast.
Mm-hmm.
And she's acting like you took her clothes and mashed wasp guts into her.
I have wasp all over my nice dress.
You were pouring wasp syrup onto...
Wasp?
Wasp. Syrup onto her Lost. Nice white linen go-out attire.
Go on. You sounded like me there for a couple minutes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You rub off. Okay. So, wasp killer.
Go ahead. So, we're dealing with that. Go out. See some friends. Go to a brewery. Decent brewery out there. Come back. It's like, all right, we're kind of happy. Had a few beers. Had a good meal. Going to sleep to wake up at like 5 a.m. To go back to work the next day. Nope. Get called at 12:30 in the evening for an outage. I have to get up at 1. I had to drive into the office at 1 a.m. Meanwhile, how to fix it? I'm trying to call up the support center. The support center is broken.
They're like, we're sleeping. Yeah. Enough.
Well, it's like, we have all this documentation. All right, I called this number. Boop, 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 boop. What are you calling about? All right, option one. You want a tech support? Yeah, I want a tech support. Boop, 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 boop. Support totally down. So now I had to run in the office. Took me an hour to fix what the problem was to come back. Also, a little side note, as I'm like trying to go out to the office, I'm like, all right, I gotta go in the office. Like, Izzy's trying to give me a lecture on, oh, you do so much for this company, you don't need to do this, you know, you don't have to go to why isn't it somebody else's job? She goes going on for like 10 minutes and I'm basically, you know, like, yeah, it's nice, honey, bye-bye.
Right. Right.
So that led to a nice little conversation the next day. And then 18 hours of moving.
18.
And show, basically gave up my entire weekend, show up on Monday just to hear, get yelled at for every other thing that occurred. And on the end note of how to think about this, so my boss sends me a text. He's like, oh, good job this weekend. Here's a $25 gift card to B-dubs.
Don't spend it all one place, buddy.
And that's the kind of thing. I'm like, on one side, I'm like, well, he didn't have to do it. It was probably out of his own pocket, so that's nice. But at the same time, like, I spent my weekend here. I got $0.00 for this.
The way I look at life these days is my time is more valuable than what I get paid.
Mm-hmm.
My time alone, or my time with my girlfriend, or my time with my dog in the woods is more valuable than any hour I could work for you. Okay? So if you're going to pay me, then I'm okay. If you're going to pay me a good amount, and it's going to be beneficial for my time and my house and my whatever, my rent, then it's worth it.
Exactly.
My time, my creative time, my everything time, my time that means the most is more valuable than anything in the world. So, like, I've turned down so many, like, video gigs and stuff like that that the time just doesn't equal the money anymore. I'm like, you know what? My valuable time of what I'd rather sit at home and research guests and get do something with this, because one day this will be something.
Mm-hmm.
And I firmly believe that. And if you're going to tell me no, you're wrong. Like, it's doing more than I ever thought it would at this point. And hopefully 3 years from now, it'll be doing more than I ever thought 3 years ago. You know, and it is what it is. And the people I have talked to and we have talked to and has always outweighed the effort. And the effort, when we really come down to it, is just sending a couple of emails and promoting things. Mm-hmm. Where, like, yeah, it's effort, but it's also out of a labor of love. So it's like, you know, it's just, you know, a couple of things on a piece of paper that not even a e-paper that's sent out. So my time, again, I'm always now I'm like, should I put this much time into this project? You know, maybe it's not always about the pay, but it's more
what's
like,
the
is
pay
it worth
for the
it?
Beefsteak bingo. Oh,
I have no idea. What's funny, Joe Fernandez asked me that. I said, no problem, buddy. I'm referring them to you. But I think it's time to get the hell out of here, man. We've been podcasting for a while. The question. We could do that.
This is in the future.
Yeah. I'll add it in. I have the question, but.
Gotcha.
Bro, let's get the hell out of here. Anything to promote?
I'll promote a friend, Kevin Garifo, and his podcast.
No.
No?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we like them.
Well, they listen to it after us. The Shining Wizards podcast. They are a wrestling podcast, which is very shocking for New Jersey comedians, but that's what they do. This week, they'll be interviewing Paul Romo, formerly of the Four Horsemen. And they do a weekly podcast. They're really fun to listen to. Get more information, facebook.com/wizardspodcast.
Yeah, they are fun. They're a good podcast. They've accomplished a lot of things, and that's why I like those guys. They've stuck with their goal, accomplished a lot of things, just like us. You know, we've accomplished a lot of, like, talking to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I'm stuck to you.
But I guess what I will promote, I'm just trying to think of when this will come out. Yes. May 13th, there's still some tickets left to the Brook Hollow Winery Show.
Oh, very nice.
$25 for a ticket. Wine and appetizer and dessert in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Morse is headlining, Ritu Chandra and Mike Ciccoli.
And it's beautiful scenery out there in Columbia, New Jersey. They're great people who run it. Definitely worth the money to go out there.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely get it. A lot of money, like, is wasted, but they are not the place that does that. Like, they understand.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I have no idea what you just said.
Yeah, me neither.
Just go to the show, damn it. I guess that's it. We're going to get the hell out of here. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Mm-hmm. And
happy belated Mother's Day, since that's the week this comes out.
Yes. It would be funny if, like, every mother was listening and then they're like, they didn't mention us. They didn't even say anything. Mm-hmm. I can't find the song I want to listen to. All right, hold on. You keep killing time. Talk about Mother's Day.
Yeah, well, Mother's Day, it was a Norwegian holiday. It was originated with them beating seals in the icy waters of the Arctic, but eventually the meat dried up, so they had to find other ways to celebrate it. So they had the fur of the seals, and they gave it to their mothers, hence Mother's Day.
Goodbye, people.
Do you want me to go on Father's Day?
I got the pogo stick. 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 Later, guys.
See ya. Been a fiend for this since rockin' made hits. Get the position down back, then it's time to switch. I rock the boat, I work the middle. I speed it up, straight beat it up. When I ain't in the hood with my toes out low, I'm in the telly working up a sweat stroke. Tonight's the night, you can fall in love. You can call your mama right now, tell her you met a dog. I pop a lot of shit cause I can back it up. My left stroke's the death stroke.
Pogo. 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 Damn it. Goodbye, guys.